Your voice.
We're holding on page Samach in Sanhedrin, Ois Kuf Lamed Aleph. We learned last time about when the Knanim came to, in the time of Alexander the Great, to lay claim to Eretz Yisrael, and Gvir ben Sisa saw them off, pointing out that that they are avodim, eved avodim yilachav, and therefore any property they own actually belongs to us Jews. So now the Gemara goes on to say similar stories that happened with two other groups as well. Gemara says, Shuf Pamachas, another time it happened, Bo B'nei Mitzrayim, Lodron Yisrael, B'nei Mitzrayim, Lodron Yisrael, Lefnei Alexander Smotein. The Egyptians came to argue with the Jewish people in front of Alexander the Great. Now, Agoy Sagro, on the Gemara over here, takes out the word Shuf Pamachas, that was another time, because he, or at least the words Pamachas, because he learns that it was all one after the other. And in fact, in Megillas Tainis and in Bereshis Rabbah, it also tells the story, it seems to say that each of these groups came back to back. The Knanim came, they tried, they were vested in the argument, they ran away, next the Mitzrayim came with their own argument, and so afterwards we're going to have Bnei Yishmael and Bnei Keturah are going to bring their own argument. So it was all on one day. On the other hand, there's a Mefardish on this Masechta called Sanhedrin Tana. He says, in fact, they were different times. Now, we learned last time that it happened on the 24th of Nisan, or in Megillas Tainis it says the 25th of Sivan, and they declared that day Yom Tov, for the fact that they had beaten this attempt by the Goyim. So he said, tackle only that one with the Knanim. Did they have reason to declare that day a Yom Tov? Because if the Knanim had won, it would mean they have complete rights to Eretz Yisrael and we have no rights at all. As opposed to here with the Mitzrayim, they're going to claim that we owe them for the gold and silver we took out of Mitzrayim. And Bnei Yishmael and Bnei Keturah are going to argue that they have a certain portion in Eretz Yisrael. They're not trying to dispossess us entirely. So the fact that Gvir ben Sisa was able to beat them, as we'll tell the story, very good, but it wasn't such a such a great thing that the Chachamim should have to declare it a minor yomtim. Okay. Anyway, so Omruloi, so the Egyptians came with the claim. Hashem gave the Jewish people favor in the eyes of the Mitzrayim, and they lent them. So they lent them gold, silver, clothing, etc. Well, they lent them means we should have it back. So give us back the gold and silver that you took from us. Now, in other words, their argument was, Marashah says, look, they know that it says in the Torah, V'yishalu ishme Yisrael. Well, then, very well, Hashem told us to borrow it, but borrowing implies that you have to return it. Amar Gvir ben Psisa l'chachamim, so again, Gvir ben Psisa says to the Chachamim, and as we learned last time, Gvir ben Psisa, as we see from these stories, was a very kluge yid, but he wasn't a member of the Sanhedrin. So he tells them, Tnu li l'shus, give me permission, ve'elech v'odun imohem, and l'fnei Alexandrus, and I will go argue the case with them in front of Alexander the Great. Im yinatzchuni, if they beat me, if they give a claim that I don't have an answer, im rulahem, then tell them, that doesn't count for much. Hed yit shabonim nitzachtem, okay, so you beat a commoner among us. Demand a rematch with one of the members of the Sanhedrin. And if I beat them, then you can tell them, don't give me the credit. The Torah of Moshe Rabbeinu beat you. As we learned last time, as Marashah says, the best way you defeat somebody is when you show the very place that he tried to bring his claim from, you're going to turn that against him and show that Adraba, from there you have a proof against him. So Gvir says, I'm going to try the same thing. And if I do, then you can say that that was the Torah itself that you're trying to use for your argument actually ended up beating you. Okay? Nosnu lo yishus, so the Chacham gave him permission, v'holach v'doni ma'am, and he went to argue the point with them. Amar lahem, he says, mehechan atam aviyam naya, where are you bringing your proof? Amar lahem min ha-Torah, so they said from the Torah. Interesting, by the way, when you think about it, this is before the Torah had even been translated into the various Goyish languages. This is Alexander the Great we're talking about. It was one of his generals eventually took over as king of Egypt after Alexander died and his empire splintered into a bunch of pieces. And then it was his son, there was the first Talmai, and then it was the second Talmai, his son, who commissioned the original translation of the Torah into Greek. Nevertheless, it seems that even before that, the Goyim were at least somewhat familiar with what it says in the Torah, maybe because they had Jews living among them. Maybe some of them were able to pick up Lashon Kodesh or whatever it was. Anyway, so they say we bring a proof from the Torah. Omalahem, so he tells them, Afani lo'ovilachem raya elam ha-Torah. Very well, my proof is also going to be specifically from the Torah. Now the Torah says, Moshe b'nei Yisrael asher yoshev b'Mitzrayim, the amount of time that the Jewish people lived in Mitzrayim, shloshim shana v'arba me'es shana, was 430 years. Now, it wasn't, in fact, they weren't in Mitzrayim that long. 430 years is from the Bris Ben Absarim. But nevertheless, the fact is, the posik, the simple meaning of the posik, and they're not necessarily going to know that it's different than that, that it was less than that, that it was 210 years, and that the slavery was even less than that. But we'll talk about in a moment what a number of Mephoshim say interesting points about why he uses this figure. Anyway, he says, well, very well then, you owe us the work for the labor of 600,000 Jews, and that's just the men, not even counting the women and children, that you enslaved in Mitzrayim for 430 years. So yeah, we borrowed from you, but on the other hand, look how much back pay you owe us. So Alexander says to them, well, give him an answer. So again, the Mitzrayim realize they've been caught flat-footed. Give us 3 days to figure out an answer. He gave them that time. They looked into it, and they couldn't find a reasonable answer. So now they realize that the Medrash, in fact, when the Medrash tells the story, says they actually sat down and started calculating it. They got even to 100 years, and they realized it would be worse than the entire Eretz Mitzrayim. So they realize that we're in trouble over here if we try to press this claim. And on the other hand, Gria tries to press his claim on behalf of the Jewish people. We're coming out the worst for it. So they ran away, they left their fields. They left their fields already planted. As we learned last time, this can mean fields in Eretz Yisrael that they had already started illegally taking over, or it can mean fields in Mitzrayim, which now the Jews can import food from there, but Kaiman Shane Tourists, and they left their vineyards already planted. When they ran away, and now the Jews are able to get all that produce. But and that year was a Shemitah year, so it benefited the Jews very much, because otherwise they didn't have crops. They wouldn't have necessarily had enough of, they would have had a shortage of food. Now, what's this business with the 430 years? The fact is the Jewish people were in Mitzrayim only 210 years. So there are Mephoshim who explain that it means that even from long before, the Mitzrayim already were starting to plot against the Jews, and we know the Gemara mentions elsewhere that when it comes to Goyim, Machshav Ra, Kadosh Baruch Hu Mitzrayim for the Maisa, that unlike with us Jews, where a person thinks to do an Avera and ends up not doing it for whatever reason, Hashem doesn't hold it against him, with the exception of Avodah Zarah, by the Goyim it's not so. So the fact that even hundreds of years earlier, they had it in for the Jewish people, is there any reason that it could be counted against them? The Chidah points out if you make a calculation, the actual amount of the, now like this, there's a variety of reasons that Chazal give. Taka, if by the Bris Ben Amsarim Hashem told them, Ara Meis Shana, 400 years, they're going to be the Eretz Lo Lahem, then why in the end was it only 210 years? And there's a lot of different explanations. Among them is because Poru Vayishvitzu, the Jewish people, increased so much that in terms of man hours, they Taka did 400 years or 430 years worth of work just during the period of the Shibud. So the Chidah makes an interesting calculation. He says the actual amount of Shibud, we find that the Shibud began around the time of the Shibud began around the time that Miriam was born, which is why she was called Miriam, Meloshon Mar, bitter. From when she was born until Yetzias Mitzrayim was 86 years. But we know, it's based on something from Parashas Zerachim, from the Mishnah Lamelach, and then the Chidah expands on it. We know that 4/5 of the Jewish people died during Makas Choshech. So it means, in other words, we're talking 600,000, but in fact, originally, before that, it was 3 million, just the men, not even counting the women and children. So therefore, you've got to multiply it by 5, and then the Chidah points out, well, very well then, it was 86 years. Well, 86 years is 1/5 of 430. So it comes out, if you're going to count 600,000 people, then you have to count 430 years. If you're going to count the original 3 million that there were, then you have to count only 86 years, but either way, it comes out to the same question. Fine. Next, continues the Gemara. V'shuv pamachas bo b'nei Shmuel of b'nei Keturah lodun in Yisrael lefnei Alexander smoked. And another time, the descendants of Yishmael and Keturah came to argue with the Jewish people in front of Alexander the Great. Again, was it actually shuv pamachas? Was it a different time? Or was it back-to-back, one after the other? So Omru Loi, and they argued, Eretz Kanan shalonu v'shalachem. Eretz Yisrael should belong equally to us and to you. So even then already, the Arabs are trying to lay claim to parts of Eretz Yisrael. Not much is new from then until now. Shenamar ve'ela tov v'shishmol ben Avraham. These are the descendants of Yishmol, the son of Avraham. Uchte ve'ela tov v'shishmol ben Avraham. So Avraham had two sons. Never for the moment, let's ignore the Bnei Pilagshin, the sons of Keturah. But at least you have the two who are explicitly called Avraham's sons, are Yitzchak and Yishmol. Well, very well then, we're entitled to a portion in Eretz Yisrael. Now, Marshall says, again, the question is, if they know what it says in the Torah, don't they know already that it says in any number of places that Hashem gave it to us and not to them? But again, they're arguing, as the Knanim did in the first argument, that you, after all, you sin, and you're now dominated by other nations, so what's the whole reason why you have any claim to Eretz Yisrael is because of the promise to Avraham Avinu. Well, then we're Bnei Yishmael, we also come from Avraham Avinu, and you're no better than us, and therefore you should split Eretz Yisrael with us. Now, also, Marsha goes on to point out that it's true that Bnei Yishmael and Bnei Keturah came. On the other hand, the main argument was from Bnei Yishmael, which is why they didn't even mention Bnei Keturah, because they figured they took the view that Yishmael is the Bechor, after all. That means you should get a double portion. So Yishmael should be entitled to 2/3 of Eretz Yisrael, and the Jewish people, according to their claim, would be entitled to only 1/3. So the Bnei Keturah are coming in as hangers on as well, but the main claim was from Bnei Yishmael.
Not even a third, because there is also Bnei Keturah, so that's...
Fine, but it would still mean that they'd be getting double as much as the Jewish people, yeah. Even Yaakov points out that it actually kind of goes in order. What happened was, first the Knanim came with their claim, and then now, in other words, he explains, if it hadn't been for the Knanim, then the Mitzriim don't have a place to argue yet, because what happens if Bnei Knan are entitled to Eretz Yisrael, then the Jewish people could argue, okay, we did borrow from you the gold and silver, but we don't have any resources to repay you because Eretz Yisrael doesn't belong to us anymore. And Eretz Yisrael is not muchzak to us because the Knanim would have their claim. Once the Knanim were dismissed, then it shows that the Jewish people have a chazaka in Eretz Yisrael. So now Mitzrayim can say, well, then if you have a chazaka in Eretz Yisrael, it's the equivalent of you have a din, for example, a gozel machalas banim, a person steals and gives it to eat to his children. So if they have a chrayis nechosim, then they're required to repay. Well, then go ahead and repay. And now when the Mitzrayim were eventually dismissed, so what happens though? But the Bnei Yishmael can't come yet. Wait a minute, then. The fact is, why are the Jewish people entitled to Eretz Yisrael? Because there was a gzeira, v'avodim ve'inuroisam, and the Jewish people went through it, and Bnei Yishmael didn't. You have a similar thing where Rashi mentions on Parshas Chukas that when they wanted to cross through Eretz Edom, then they sent a message to the king of Edom that said, look, there was a shtar choiv on all of us, on Yitzchak, on Yishmael, on Yaakov, and on Esav, and we went through it. We paid off the shtar choiv. You didn't, so at least let us pass through your land. So now the Bnei Yishmael realize the same thing. If we just come now with a claim to Eretz Yisrael, the answer is going to be, yeah, but the Jewish people went through the suffering of the Shibud, and we didn't, so we don't necessarily have a leg to stand on. Now that they just got paid off, now that it was clear that they had been paid, in effect, paid off by the Mitzrayim, now the Bnei Yishmael can come with an argument, well, in that case, fine, you went through the Shibud, but you got paid for it. So now we're back to the regular rules of Yerusha. So again, they argued that they should be entitled to a portion of Eretz Yisrael, maybe even a larger portion based on them, on Yishmael being the Bechor. Again, Amalahem Gvir ben Psisa l'chachamim t'nulu l'shus ve'elech l'adon imam. So Gvir ben Psisa tells the Chacham, give me permission to go to them, to go argue with them with Alexandrus, in front of Alexander. Imi natschuni yemu hedit shabon enitzachtem, v'im ani anatzeach oisim imu lahem teras Moshe ben enitzachtechem. Same thing, if I lose, then I'm just a hedit. If I win, then it was the Torah that won. Nosna l'shus, they gave him permission v'holach v'don imam, and he went to argue the point with them. Omalahem, mehechnatim mevian raya, where you bring your proof. Omalahem, minatoda, so they say we're bringing from the Torah. Omalahem, so he answers them, afanilo oviraya el minatoda. Very well, my counter argument is also going to come from the Torah. Shenemar, the passage says, Vayitin Avraham as kolashaloi the Yitzchak. Avraham gave everything that he had to Yitzchak. So now Marshall points out that in the Medrash it actually takes it in a different sense, because before you already have earlier in Parshas Chayesara, when he sent Eliezer to Haran, then he already had a Shtar Matana with him that Avraham had given everything to Yitzchak. So then why would you need to repeat it over here? It means the Medrash says, and then Rashi brings it on the Pasuk, that he gave him the ability to give brachos, which Avraham had from Hashem, and now he handed that over to Yitzchak. But now our Gemara is taking it in the simple sense that it means exactly that then there was no Shtar Matana. You don't necessarily have to say according to Pshuta Shom Mikra that there was a Shtar Matana. Avraham had given him things to bring to Rivka's family. He had given him the jewelry and the bracelets and the whatnot that he gave to Rivka, and later on the McDonald's and the clay kesef for Zahav that he gave to Rivka and her family. Doesn't mean he gave everything to Yitzchak. Now he gave everything to Yitzchak. So he gave everything to Yitzchak, and the pasuk continues, "V'libnei pilagshim asher l'Avraham," as far as the sons of the pilagshim that had of Avraham, namely Hagar and Keturah, "Nosan Avraham matonis." So to them, Avraham gave presents, and he didn't give them part of the Yerusha. So it says Gvia to the Yishmaelim and the Bnei Keturah, av shekosav antin or shenosan agtin levona b'chayim. Well, then, if a father gives a shtar saying that he's giving a matnas bori or a matnas shivna, as the case may be, that he's giving an official document of tzava to his sons when he's alive. The word agtin might be related to the word distantly related to the word legacy in English, in that he explicitly gives his legacy, his yiruch. The shigur zem alzeh, and he sends one away from the other. Klum yesh lazal zeh klum. Then do they have any further claims against the other? No. So since Avraham took care of the whole matter while he was alive, then you have no claims to anything of Eretz Yisrael anymore. Now Marsha brings up the interesting point which the Mizrahi first brings up, which how could Avraham do that anyway? Back in Bava Basra, a couple of months back, we learned that in fact you're not supposed to do that. Even if one son is a no good nick, or more than one is a no good nick, you're really not supposed to disinherit them. We had a story in that connection with Yossi Ben Yezer. We had other stories in that connection. The Mizrahi gives an answer, but the Marsha gives a different answer. Anyway, he was the son of a Shifcha. So the son of a Shifcha doesn't Yarshin. What about Bnei Keturah? He's already also in a Shifcha. Keturah was a free woman. Nevertheless, she's still a Pilegish, and therefore so her children are not really in line to Yarshin the way that Yitzchak would.
You could have told them, since you are a son of Shifcha, you belong to me. So,
well, but again, as far as Yishmael, maybe, although even then, by that time, Hagar and Pashas had been freed, especially if you say that Hagar is Keturah, as Rashi mentions on the Pasuk. But Keturah, Marsha is saying over here, since he married her after he had a bris milah, he wouldn't have been allowed to marry a goita anymore. He would have necessarily, or Shifcha, he would have necessarily had to be Meshachra her. Nevertheless, she was still only a Pilegish and not a full-fledged wife. I mean, in halacha, it's not necessarily so glatt. Just because children are the son of a pilegish is not a reason to disinherit them. We have with Yiftach, for example, where Yiftach Hagiladi was the son of a pilegish of an Isha Zoyna, and his brothers kicked him out of the inheritance, and he complains that you treated me unjustly. But okay, at least there's a basis at least to make that distinction. So with that, he won the argument. Interestingly, here it doesn't say that they ran away and left all their fields and everything. Maybe they hadn't started taking over property, you know, it's Israel. Yet the Chal, they're Bnei Yishmael and Bnei Turah, they tend to be nomads, and maybe they probably didn't have fields or vineyards for the Jewish people to take over.
They are not arguing that...
Well, they were arguing that part of Eretz Yisrael should belong to them, isn't it?
There is no counter-argument that, you won't meet.
No, there's not. Right. That's true. Actually, that is true. That's a fair point. Right. So maybe they didn't have as much of a reason, and maybe they didn't have as much of a reason to run away. That's a good point. So the Gemara says, by the way, since we're talking that Avraham gave them matonis, my matonis, what gifts exactly did he give them? If the point was he wanted to give his whole Yerusha to Yitzchak, then what exactly did he give them? Or you could say if it was actual matanos, then why is it important for us to know? So Amar Rabbi Yumi Ba'aba Malamet Shemasa Lahem Shem Tuma. This teaches them that he gave them over a name of Tuma. So what does that mean? Rashi explains. He tells them Kishuf and Maisa Shadim, and how Shadim act, and like how to work with them or whatever. Now many Mefarshim deal with the question: how could Avraham do that? Starting with Marsha says, Avraham, we know, kept the whole Torah. How could he teach them Kishuf? Well, first of all, we learned earlier in the Masechta, you're not allowed to learn Kishuf to do it, but you can learn it, Lahavin or Lahoris. You can learn it in order to understand it and to be able to teach about it. So that might be a reason why he taught it to them, so that they'll know how it works and be able to judge cases about it, but not that they should use it themselves. They may have ended up using it themselves, but that wasn't Avraham's intention. Marsha, though, does point out that this would also, we learned earlier in the Masechta, when we talked about the Shev Mitzvah Bnei Noach, the Gemara discusses over there, there was an opinion that Bnei Noach are not allowed to do Kishuf. We would have to say that all Gemara then goes according to that. If Bnei Noach are not allowed to do Kishuf, then why would he be teaching them Kishuf? It would be Lifnei Eiver. In any case, Maharshal says that actually, in that case, it may not have been, maybe we wouldn't take up what Rashi said, that it was both Kishuf and Maisa Shadim. Maybe it was only Maisa Shadim. He taught them how to use Shadim for your purposes, which is much more allowed in Halacha, as we touched on earlier in the Masechta, and we're going to have later on in our Perek as well. We're going to have that to a certain extent, you are allowed to call on Shadim. It's not considered part of Kishuf. So that's Maharshal. You have a lot of different explanations. Among different Mefoshim, it can mean that he taught them this in order to protect themselves against Shadim and against Kishuf. He needed to separate them from Kedusha. So therefore he's gonna make them like marked off that now they belong to Klippus, they belong to Truma, and therefore they belong with Shadim and with Kochas HaTruma and that kind of thing. And then there's an interesting explanation from Rebbe Gumiller, who says what he did is he taught them all kinds of natural sciences. But now, again, you know, with those, a person can do all kinds of things that to those people who don't know those sciences look like magic. So that would mean that he taught them Kishuf and Maisa Shadim, things that they could claim. They may end up falsely claiming that they're using Shadim and they're using Kishuf or whatever, but really, it's they're using their knowledge of science to accomplish things that the average goy over there where they went to wouldn't know what's special about it. There are some people like to point out that maybe a lot of like this, the pasuk says he sent them to Eretz Kedem to the east, which would include all the way east, all the way to India. And famously, you know, they have a lot of magic and a lot of philosophy and a lot of whatnot. That some of it at least may be an echo of what Abraham taught them. Going on now to we were talking about Tchiyas Nesim, so now let's talk about a point related to that. You have a guf and you have a neshama. So Omale Antoninus the Rebbe. So Antoninus points out to Rebbe. This is the famous Roman Emperor Antoninus, who was a friend of Rebbe. We're gonna have more about him in the Masechta Avodah Zarah in a few months. We have all over Shas and Midrash, and we have different stories of him and Rebbe together. There's even an opinion in the Yerushalmi that eventually he became a ger. Reb Levi Yitzchak actually points out a fascinating thing about it. He says the gematrios of the name Antoninus and of Rabbi Yehuda, which was Rebbe's name, was Rabbi Yehuda, are identical. They both add up to the same amount, says Reb Levi Yitzchak, showing how close they were. Anyway, so Antoninus says to Rebbe, Gufu neshama yecholim lifter at, and they're also they're you know, we were just talking about, we're going to talk later on about Yaakov and Esav. They were the representatives of each one. Rebbe is descended from Yaakov. Antoninus is descended from Esav. So Amalei Antoninus for Rebbe, Gufu neshama yecholim lifter atzman min adin. On the face of it, when it comes to the Yom Adin, the body and the neshama can each claim that they're potter and they don't deserve any punishment. Ketzad, what does that mean? Guf Oimer, the Guf is going to say, you're going to punish me for the Averis. Neshama Chata, it's the Neshama that did the Averis. Shemiyem Shepeir Shemimeni, ever since the Neshama left me, Harini Muto, Kevin Doimim Bekebra. I'm like a mute stone in the grave. I can't do anything by myself. I was only able to do something because there was a Neshama inside me. So you should ask Hashem, you should punish the Neshama. And the Neshama Imenes, and the Neshama is going to counter Guf Chota. It's the Guf that sinned. Shem Yem Shepirashti Mimenu. Ever since I left the Guf, Harini Pareach Ba'aver Katzipur. I'm flying around in the air like a bird. Now, Maharshal points out this is we're talking about the Neshamas of Rishoyim of Choytim. So therefore, Taka it has no rest and it's flitting around always like a bird. Neshamas of Tzadikim go to a place of Menucha in Yeshiva Shomayla, so they're not going to be that. But Antoninus is saying a Rosha, a Baal Averus, could make that claim. So how is Hashem going to punish them? Omalei, so Rebbe answers him, Emshalachom Moshe Lamar Devadrema. Here, I'll give you an analogy to understand it. Imagine you have a melech bas of Adam who had a beautiful orchard. And there were beautiful, oody, ripening figs in it. So the king put up two watchmen in this orchard. Echad chigir ve'echad suma. One of them is lame, the other one is blind. One day the lame one says to the blind one, so the lame one can see, the blind one can't, but the lame one can't get around by himself. So he says, Bakuris noa niroi bapardis. I see nice udi ripening figs in the orchard. And we always find, even in Tanakh, you have that udi ripening figs are like a special treat. So boi vahakiveni, so come, you blind person, let me ride on your shoulders, I can't walk. Or nevi'im ma'ochlam, and then I'll go pick them, and we'll be able to eat them together. Rochav Chigra Agabe Suma, sure enough, the lame one rides, gets onto the blind one's shoulders. And so now the one on top, the lame one, is directing him where to go. They have Vium and they pick them and they brought them, the Ochlam and they ate him. The Yomim Bobala Pardis, eventually the master of the orchard, the king, shows up. Omalaham, and he says to them, Bakuris Nois Heichenheim, where are those beautiful, uli ripening figs? Omalay Suma. So now each of them tries to play dumb. The blind one says, Klum Yeshli Anayim Liris, do you think I have eyes to see? I can't see, so I certainly couldn't have taken them. Omalay Figur, and the lame one says, Klum Yeshli Raglaim Lahalak Behem, do I have feet to walk? I couldn't have done it either. So they're both trying to evade responsibility. But the king was smart enough to realize what happened over here. Ma also, what did he do? Hirkiv Chigur Agabe Suma. He had them do exactly that. He had the lame one ride on the sit on the blind one's shoulders, the exact position where they committed the crime. The donors and kachar, and then he judged and punished them together. So says Rebbe Tantininus. Afa Kodesh Baruch Hu. So Hashem does the same kind of thing. Maybe it's an neshama v'zorka baguf. Hashem takes the neshama and throws it back into the body. The donos and keechod, and then he judges them together. Shenemar, as the pasuk says, Yikra el Shamayim Me'ol, Hashem will call to the heavens above, meaning the neshama that comes from Shamayim. Ve'ela Oretz, and the pasuk continues, Ve'ela Oretz Lodin Amay, and to the earth to judge his people. So Yikra el Hashem to the earth to judge his people. Marsha points out the word Amay can also be understood as if it said Imay with it. So therefore, so it means that the guf and the neshama are together. Yikra l'shamayim me'olzu neshama, ve'ala arz lodin amoy zeha guf, so Hashem puts them together. Different mepharshim have a variety of different explanations. What does this mean? Does it mean that does it actually mean that the Rishoyim are brought alive by Tchias HaMesim to receive their punishment? Or does it mean, when we say the guf over here, do we mean maybe the nefesh of Bahamas? Do we mean maybe the nefesh asichlis? Do we mean, and there's a number of different parts, and then when we say the zirka baguf, it can mean the matter of gilgulim. There's a variety of different explanations that the mafoshim say what exactly it means that Hashem is going to do over here. But in any case, the point is they can't get away with it because it's true. Either one couldn't have done it by himself, but it's al-derech, like you have a halacha in Hilchos Shabbos, Shnayim Shasta or Pturim. You have two people drew a malacha together, their potter. However, if it was a malacha that neither one could have done by themselves, carrying, let's say, a heavy beam, where neither one could have carried it by themselves, then in fact they're chayiv. So therefore, so here it's the same thing with the neshama and the body. Each one couldn't have done it by itself, but the combination can do it, and therefore they can be punished that way. Okay. Next, since we're talking about what things that Antoninus asked the Rebbe, so now the Gemara brings a couple of other things between them. Omele Antoninus the Rebbe, Mipnei Mach, well now we're going to have other stories about them in the Masecht Avodah Zarah. There we're going to have where Antoninus had to ask Rebbe about matters of statecraft, of how to deal with his government and with his family matters or whatever. Here the Gemara is focusing on questions that Antoninus asked Rebbe in matters of Ashkafa, in matters of understanding how the Eibishter runs the world. And you have other places also, by the way. You have, for example, that Yerushalmi that mentions about Antoninus about Antoninus becoming a ger. The Yerushalmi tells over there that Antoninus one time asks Rebbe, if you ever have the schus to bring a korban, let's say, l'asid lavei, to bring a korban Pesach, would I be able to eat from it? So, and Rebbe says no. So Antoninus says, wait a minute, you've previously told me that I would be able to share in the sudas levyosin with you. Why not the korban Pesach? So Rebbe says, well, Sudas Levyosin, there's no halachas about who can and can't eat from it. You're a chassid or masorilam, you deserve to eat from the Levyosin, but the Korban Pesach clearly says, kol ora lo yechal boy. And therefore, Santaninus was motivated by that to become a ger. Okay, continues the Gemara over here. Omalei Antoninus the Rebbe, mitnei mach kama yotze b'mizrach shakats b'mayrev. Why does the sun rise in the east and set in the west? Now, on the face of it, he's asking, why Dafka east and west? Why not, let's say, why doesn't it rise in the west and set in the east? Omalei, so Rebbe says, what kind of question is that? No matter which direction it rose and set, you would be asking the same thing. Hashem had to pick some direction it's going to rise from and some direction it's going to set from. So what's the question? Omalei, so Antoninus explains, Hachi Kaminullah. What I mean to say with my question, you didn't understand my question, Grefti. What I'm asking is, why Dafka does it have to set in the west? Namely, in other words, Rashi explains that the question is, Antoninus is asking, why didn't Hashem make it that the sun can just go round and round until, so it's going to rise in the east, it's going to make a complete circuit of the sky back to the east, and then it will set there. In other words, usually a person goes back in the place where he came out from, the same way you would expect if the sun comes out in the east, then it should also go in and set in the east. So the Maharal has a bit of a different explanation of it. He explains that Antoninus was asking that the sun should always be in the sky. It should never have to set at all. Now, the Maharal points out over here, it is a little bit of a doichik. I mean, so then where would it go after it sets over there? You're going to say it's going to stay in the east all night. So Maharal explains the question is basically like this. The heavenly bodies here, now in Perek Echad of Rambam these days is Hilchos Kiddush HaChodesh, and the Rambam deals over there with the motions of the sun and the moon, and it becomes clear from the Rambam's description that the sun and moon, and this is true of the other heavenly bodies as well, we see them all revolving around the earth in an east to west motion. Each of them we see it rises in the east and then it sets, and then it sets in the west. But their actual proper motion, their actual independent motion, as we see from the way that Amnon describes it, is actually the other way around, from west to east. So therefore, for example, the sun, for example, that Amnon describes, moves about 1 degree per day. So every day, it completes almost the complete circuit of the sky, but it's missing 1 degree, basically. And then you need a few extra minutes to make up that extra degree. So the question then really is, Maharal explains, so he's wondering, why is it, the question is why it rises in the east and sets in the west. So the question was, though, that given that their actual proper motion is from west to east, then why is it not that way? But then Rebbe says, if it was the other way around, if its proper motion was east to west, and then it went in the sky west to east, you'd ask the same thing. So he says, no, I'm asking, why are they in opposite directions? If its own proper motion is from west to east, then its daily motion should also be from west to east. So Rebbe answers him, Amaleke de litin shalom lekoina. The reason is so that the sun will give shalom, will bow and give obeisance to its owner. The Shekhinah is in the west, the Gemara mentions in various places. So therefore, as the sun starts descending towards the west, it looks like it's bowing towards Hashem. And then it sets there. Shenema, as the pasuk says, it's Vashemayim l'chol mishtachrim. The hosts of heaven bow to you. So that's the idea that this way it's bowing to Hashem. As Altad Eber points out in Tanya, this is one of the ways of developing a Yira of the Eivishter. Altad Eber mentions in Tanya in one of the mems, I don't remember which perek, that if you in Perek Aleph from Mendez, I think, that if you were to walk into a king's courtyard, into the palace compound, and you don't know who the king is, but all of a sudden you see a bunch of high-level ministers who you recognize, and you see them bowing all to one guy over there, and you have an aim of a fahad. So therefore, the same way you see that the tremendous sun and moon and the other heavenly bodies, they all bow toward the west, then it gives you a certain idea of the, starts giving you an idea of the greatness of the Eivishter. And in particular, the Maharal says that's the idea. In other words, that Rebbe is telling him, if the sun was always in the sky, as it is, you have people who worship the sun. If it was always in the sky, all the more so. We know Avram, how did Avram first start discovering that there's an Eivishter, is because he realized the sun and the moon and everything else always rises and sets. So therefore, Sasha had to make it set. It can't just be always circling in the sky, and the reason it sets in the west is because that's where the Shekhinah is. Okay, then the sun should go up until the middle of the sky, the titin shloma, and from there it should bow to Hashem, the tail, and then it should immediately set from the middle of the sky. Why is it instead? It takes hours for it to gradually descend down the horizon. And Rebbe answers him, Hashem could have arranged that, but the problem is then it would all of a sudden get dark in the middle of the day, and that would be a problem. Mishum poilim, because of workers are going to think they still have plenty of time until it gets dark, and all of a sudden the sun is going to set, and all of a sudden they're in darkness. And travelers, same thing. They're going to figure it's bright daylight, and we have plenty of time, and all of a sudden the sun is going to set unexpectedly on them. So therefore, as a chesed to them, the Eivishter makes that the sun gradually sets, and it takes a while, but that way, the whole afternoon, while it's setting, and in particular when it reaches the west, then it's bowing to Hashem. So the Gemara continues. On the way, Antoninus the Rebbe. Rebbe Antoninus has another question for Rebbe. Neshama me'emasai nitna ba'odem. From what point in a person's development, in a baby's development, is a neshama placed into him? Meshas pkida or meshas yitzira? Is it from the time of pkida or from the time of formation? Rashi explains that pkida would be, the Gemara tells us in Nida, that when a baby is first conceived, the malach, a malach takes that fertilized drop and brings it before Hashem, and at that point the whole course of that baby's life is determined, except tzaddik v'rosha loy ka'amah. Hashem doesn't determine whether it's going to be a tzaddik or a rosha, but everything else is going to be smart or not so smart, strong or weak, etc. All of that is predetermined at that time. So that's called pkida. The Yad Ramah explains a little differently. He says the pkida is the actual moment of conception. Whatever. Antoninus is asking, does the neshama come in at that point, by meshas yitzira, or from when the baby is formed, which would be when you have bus of gidim bat samos, which is a minimum of 40 days after, which is 40 days after conception. There is an opinion in Gemara Nida that's 40 for a boy and 80 for a girl, matching the amount of yamei tara and yamei truma after a baby is born, but the halacha is not like that. The halacha, the accepted opinion, is it's 40 for both. So is it then, or is it 40 days later? Omalei meshas yitzira. So Rebbe tells him from the time the baby is formed. Omalei, but Antoninus says that doesn't seem to work. Efshel hatichas or boser and medes shloishi yomim blei melach. How could it be a piece of meat that's going to stay there for 3 days without salt, without anything to preserve it? The enem asrachas and it won't spoil. There has to be a neshama in there right away, otherwise it would spoil right away. Now, okay, the Rif points out over here that Rebbe thought that maybe the baby can live off the neshama of the mother, but Antoninus is saying still it doesn't seem to work out. Now, to be sure, we say ma'ayin basim itipas srucha. All that means is, in other words, it doesn't. It's not completely srucha. If it was srucha, if it was spoiled, it wouldn't turn into a baby. It means it's on the verge of becoming srucha, and then the Eibishter saves it and then causes it to actually start developing. So this is Marsha says. So therefore he says it must be from the time of pkida, from when Hashem determines, or from the moment of fertilization, it already has an neshama. And he says, yeah, must be from the time of pkida. Omar Rebbe, Dovazel and Dani Antoninus. Antoninus taught me this point. Mikra Messiah. And there's actually a posik that supports what he says. Shenema, Ufgudos Hashem Reruchi, in one of Eve's speeches, he's speaking to Hashem and saying, you know, Hashem, you created me out of virtually nothing. So now that you created me, why are you not having a Rachmanos on me? And he describes in brief the whole process of the formation of a baby. And he says, Ufgudos from your pkida, from when you mention and determine what my future is going to be, shamra ruchi, already then my ruach was protecting me.
According to halacha, I think it is 40 days. So
halacha is 40 days as far as that up till that point it's still considered maya ba'alma, it's considered like water, and therefore that has certain implications as far as the dinim of tumah v'tara and as far as abortion and things like that, right? But now the Gemara is saying that already even before that it already has a neshama, which the neshama is being preserved in the body. Or Marsha learns a little bit differently, that the soul preserves my body, preserves my forming body in the womb from spoiling. Gomi Rowanach. Okay, Hashem saw, first of all, that was Adam edition, mostly speaking, Hashem, that he said, so Hashem, you saw my unformed form. Okay, but even for the rest of us also, of course, Hashem sees it, but the question is not Hashem seeing it, the question is, does it have an neshama? So now the answer is yes, already from Pekidah, already from when it starts forming, from when it's fertilized, and from when it's determined by Hashem what its future is going to be, already then it has an neshama. Okay. Another question, Amalei Antoninus the Rebbe, Yetzahara me'emasai sholech bo ba'adam. At what point does the Yetzahara start having any influence on a person? Meshas yitzira or meshas yitzia, from when he's formed in the womb, or only when he comes out of the womb and is born? Amalei meshas yitzira. So Rebbe tells him from when the baby is formed in the womb. Amalei, but Antoninus says that doesn't seem to work either. Im Cain, if a baby already had a Yetzahara in the womb, Yibot be'imei v'yetzeh, he would kick his mother and he would come out. Now we'll talk about Esav in a second. Did was trying to do just that. We'll get to that in a moment. But anyway, but a normal baby would also do that. It would want out of there, especially if learning Torah in the womb. If it already has a Yetzahara, then it's not going to be wanting to learn Torah over there. Ella, Mishas Yetzia. Rather, it must be from when the baby is born. Omer Rebbe, Dover Zelim Dani Antoninus. Antoninus taught me this point as well. That cost of Messiah. And in fact, again, a pasuk supports him. Shenemala Pesach Chatas Roivitz. Sin crouches by the door, meaning as soon as a person exits the doors of the womb, then already he had, then at that point he gets a Yetzirah, but not before that. One of the interesting explanations in Mephoshim is, in fact, that the point is a person learns Torah in the womb, a baby learns Torah in the womb, and therefore that taka protects, therefore that prevents the Yetzirah from having any influence on him. On the other hand, they talk about in that connection that the question may have been mainly as far as Gerusha babies. They don't learn Torah in the womb, so therefore the question would be, if they had a Yetzirah in the womb, then the taka, they would kick their way out, and the answer is that, no, they only get it when they're born. Now, Marsha points out that there's a story in the Gemara in Yuma that tells that one time there was a pregnant woman who, on Yom Kippur, she was having cravings. And the cravings, when a pregnant woman has cravings, then in Halacha we say it's because of the baby. That's the baby that has cravings and therefore is having an effect on the mother. So the din is, and the Gemara tells over there, that Rebbe told them, whisper in her ear that it's Yom Kippur. So the Gemara tells two stories over there, one with the mother of Rabbi Yochanan, where they whispered that to her, and Taka's cravings calmed down, and Rebbe said that shows that this baby has the capability of being a great tzaddik, and it was Rabbi Yochanan. And then on the other hand, there was another case like that, where it didn't help, and they realized that he has a tendency to become a Rasha, and in fact he became a notorious Rasha, who used to hoard produce in times of shortages in order to drive up the prices and take advantage of the poor. Now, so the question is, on the face of it, there he has a Yetzirah already in the womb. So Maharsha explains that, fine, he has a mother, he's in his mother's womb, she has a Yetzirah. So therefore, to that extent, it can have an effect on him even in the womb. But his own personal Yetzirah doesn't have an effect on him in the womb, because otherwise he would kick his way out. Now, then Maharsha brings up the point, what about Taka, Yaakov, and Esav? So with that, there's a variety of different explanations, including that maybe indeed Esav was unusual in that regard and did indeed have a Yetzirah in the womb. And there's a lot of different points about that, but one very interesting one that Eber points out in the Sicha and Chelek Chof, that what it may have meant when Esav was kicking every time they passed by a base of Avodah Zarah, not because he wants to go out and worship Avodah Zarah. Fakir, because because he's in the neshama of a Baal Teshuva. He wants to go out there and destroy that Yetzirah. So therefore, it's not that he has a Yetzirah yet, it's that he has a tendency towards this Avodah Zarah over here. We got to do something about it. So unfortunately, eventually, later on, it came out, we got to do something about it, as we got to worship it. But originally, it would have been while he was in the womb. He was still a son of Yitzchak and Rivka and didn't have a Yetzirah yet, and there it would have been a more positive kind of thing. Okay. Yonye Mashiach of Ola. Chavov Menachemov. So there was a guy who was by dollars or something and asked a bracha for himself and his family, and he was asking this and that and the other, and finally the Rebbe says to him, maybe you should already ask that Mashiach should come. And the guy answers him, Yirtzeh Hashem. And the Rebbe answers him, the Eishter already wants. Hashem wants that Jews should also want it. So you can't just fob it off as a Yirtzeh Hashem, we gotta want it too. Okay. Continuing on halachas of tefillin. So we started learning last time that if a person took off this tefillin and plans to only put them on a couple of hours later, then he changes his mind and puts them on earlier, then he would say a bracha on them. But if when he took them off, he intended to put them on shortly afterwards, and he does that, then he doesn't make another bracha. But medvarim amurim, though, when would that apply? If he didn't go to the bathroom in between. But if he went to the bathroom in between, now in the bathroom he can't wear tefillin. So therefore, it doesn't matter that he intended to put him back on shortly after. Therefore, he would, in fact, have to make a second bracha when he puts him on again, just as if he didn't have in mind to put him on again at all. That is the final halacha, yeah. In addition, also in the footnotes over here, he points out that if a person puts on a different pair of tefillin, even if it wasn't the bathroom in between, then he would have to make another bracha anyway. Talking when we say different pair of tefillin, we mean a different pair of rashis, of course. But even if it's the same tefillin, if in between he went to the bathroom, then he would in fact have to make the bracha again. Now, in a later siman, we're going to talk about the proper places where the tefillin are supposed to be, the shoyad and shorosh respectively. Now, let's say they moved out of place, and you're handling them and you're moving them to put them back in their place. Then also, they would have to make another bracha on them, because since they moved away, shaloi midaita, without him intending to, then it doesn't matter that he intends to put him back in the right place. We don't say, in other words, that since he wanted to wear them, the fact that they're in the wrong place doesn't matter. So he would in fact have to make the bracha now when he puts it back in the right place. Although the Altareba goes on to mention in the next siman that not necessarily so, but wait, first he says, now, if he's only putting back one of them, then he would make the bracha as if he's only putting on one tefillin, which would be the respective bracha l'aniach tefillin for shoyad and al mitzvah tefillin for shoroish, as the case may be. But now, on the other hand, that's if they accidentally moved out of place. If he deliberately moved them out of place for whatever reason and planned to put them back in the right place, so let's say, for example, he has an itch or something and he moved them in order to scratch himself and then he puts them back, then he doesn't have to make another bracha. Now, the Altareba goes on to say, then, that nowadays the Olam has the minhag that even if the tefillin moved out of place accidentally and he puts him back, you don't make a bracha. Now, why should that be if we just said that you're supposed to? So there's a shalach, Kodesh gives a reason. That when would that be that you have to make another bracha? Was back in the time when people wore tefillin all day and they slipped out of place, not during the time of davening. So he's not really having such a das, he's not really having such a focus on them. It's true, you can't have hesach das when you're in tefillin, but he's still not as focused on them as he is during davening. We, though, only wear them during the time of davening, and then a person is mistama, not masiach das from them, and he feels when they move out of place, so therefore it can be considered as if he moved them himself, planning to put him back, and we just said that he doesn't make a bracha in that case. So the ma'isa, if they slip out of place, then we don't actually make another bracha, and all the more so if he moved them out of place deliberately and then put him back right back afterwards.